Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And it's the kind of news day in which the president, once demanding a loyalty oath from the FBI director he fired, is no longer top news. On Twitter this morning, President Trump wrote, "James Comey better hope that there are no tapes of our conversations before he starts leaking to the press." The president was referring to his claim that Comey told him he wasn't under investigation. Some are saying that tweet could be witness intimidation. Comey's been invited to hearings next week.
Let's bring in our Friday roundtable. Joining us, Juana Summers, CNN politics editor. Hi, Juana.
Hi there.
And Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent. Hi, Ron.
Good to be with you.
And let me start with you, Juana. I think there's a big question of why is the White House handling this Comey firing this way? The president does have the ability and the authority to fire the FBI director, but why change the story about why it was done? Why have a meeting the day after the firing with the Russian foreign minister in the Oval Office? And why meet with Henry Kissinger when everybody is making Watergate comparisons?
In addition, why make a reference to tapes?
Right.
If I could answer all of those questions, you guys, I would be a very, very rich woman. But look, I think the bottom line is that the responsibility for all of this falls at President Trump's feet, right? He is the person going out and sending these directives. He is the person who on Twitter today suggested that Comey should hope that there are no tapes of the conversations, drawing, of course, comparisons to President Richard Nixon. I think this shows just how much of a prime driver this president is. He completely goes around his own staff to even send these messages out to the American people using Twitter. And so I think to get the real answers to any of those questions, frankly, you'd have to ask him.
But Ron, to that tweet, is that witness intimidation? Is that something more than it's threatening, but is it something more?
It is threatening in the sense that he is clearly saying that if James Comey should be sharing information with anyone, just perhaps having some anonymous phone calls with reporters, because after all, there were only a couple of people who could report on that conversation. If that's happening, and obviously the president thinks that it is, then, the former FBI director should be careful because there might be, quote, tapes, unquote. Now, what does it mean to put the word tapes in quotes? That's strange. It calls attention to it in perhaps a somewhat oblique way. But the point is, the president is saying that my version of what happened in that conversation is different from yours, and I might have proof that my version is correct, and you better hope I don't. It's almost on a schoolyard level of threat.
Talk about how analysts are weighing in on this with the thinking of, would this have happened? I mean, would an FBI director tell a president that he wasn't under investigation?
That is a good question because, generally speaking, we have been told that would not happen. There are perhaps ways that the conversation could have resulted in that impression in the president's mind. For example, he could have said, all right, you're investigating some of my associates and their possible contacts to Russians, but that's where the investigation is going right now. And perhaps Comey could have said yes to that, and then the president could have said, well, I'm not one of my associates, and I didn't have those contacts with the Russians. Therefore, that means he's not investigating me personally.
Well, and the conversation that's been happening all week, and it seems like it's getting louder and louder, is there's got to be a special prosecutor to look into this. It can't go the normal way. Juana, is that likely at this point? Because Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, seems to indicate that he doesn't want to go that route.
It doesn't seem likely for exactly that reason, Jeremy. You're not hearing Republicans really come on board. This has almost been, at least in the halls of Capitol Hill, really split down partisan lines. A lot of Democrats, of course, eager to see that happen. But the odds of that happening when Donald Trump and the Republican Party have control of both the House and Senate, I don't see that being very likely unless this continues to drip, 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 or there's something else huge that happens that would cause Republicans to come on board.
Well, without that, Ron, how do you get to the bottom of what really happened with Russia and maybe members of the Trump team?
You have a couple of possibilities. One is the Senate Intelligence Committee, which is chaired by Richard Burr of North Carolina, Republican, of course, because all the chairs are Republicans in this Senate, and also has, as its ranking member, Mark Warner of Virginia, a very aggressive Democrat, and they seem to have been making some progress. They are subpoenaing people. They are actually doing things. Now, whether or not they would be as independent as, say, the Senate Investigating Committee back in 1972 1973 that investigated Watergate that was entirely independent of any of the regular committee structure and was almost essentially equally chaired by a Republican, Howard Baker, and a Democrat, Sam Ervin. That committee had a great deal of credibility right from the very beginning. It showed a great deal of integrity. It got to the tapes issue with Richard Nixon, and that's how Watergate turned into the resignation of Richard Nixon. Now, obviously, the Republicans don't want to see that happen again. They hope to contain all of this within the Senate Intelligence Committee, but that committee is moving forward, and that, at this point, is probably our best hope to get to the bottom.
Well, let's hear a little bit from the chair. We know that NBC News released more of Lester Holt's interview with the president. In part of that interview, he called James Comey a showboat. And asked about that, Senate Intelligence Committee Chair Republican Richard Burr, who you've been discussing, disagreed.
I found him to be one of the most ethical, upright, straightforward individuals I've had the opportunity to work with. He provided our committee more access to information than any director of the FBI.
So there's that, and also in testimony this week, the standing head of the FBI said the same thing, disagreed with Donald Trump's assessment of the FBI as something in disarray. This president is lashing out. How does he appear? How does he appear on the world stage? How does he appear?
I think that's a really good question. I think the biggest takeaway I have as I'm following the president's actions in both public and private comments is that this White House no longer has the presumption of truthfulness. There has been so much doubt cast on President Trump's version of events when it comes to former Director Comey, there have been comments about the fact that, instead of just kind of following the proper channels on this, he takes to Twitter to, again, kind of pour salt in the wound, for lack of a better word, of a situation that's already garnering a lot of attention and skepticism. So I do think there are some concerns from both Republicans and Democrats as to how not just this White House appears, but how this will play in the world. I do think, to your point from playing that clip from Comey earlier, I think that one thing we are very likely to see is there's going to be some dramatically ratcheted up pressure for former Director Comey to testify before Congress and clear his name to rebut the president's version of events, because if not, this man who is a storied Washington type who has been in law enforcement for a long time, this could really, really destroy his legacy. So I'll be curious to see if he accepts the invitation he's been giving to address the Senate Intelligence Committee on Tuesday.
As we spend almost our entire roundtable talking about Comey and the firing of Comey, I want to just remind people that it was just over a week ago that the House passed that healthcare bill, which was the talk of Washington at the time. Now, the members of Congress who voted for it are getting an earful from their constituents. Let's listen here to what happened to New Jersey Republican Tom MacArthur at a town hall.
I am watching an insurance market that is collapsing. And here's why it's collapsing.
Because you drill holes in it, they say. Ron, Has just all the oxygen been sucked out of the room by the Comey stuff? And what's happening with healthcare? Is it likely that the Senate is going to be able to put something together?
The oxygen's been sucked out in Washington by the Comey matter, mm-hmm. but not in the country. In the country, people are much more concerned about what's going to happen to their health care. And that is bringing people out to these town halls. And Tom MacArthur is uniquely responsible for what just happened in the House, because he sat down with the hardcore conservatives. Now, he is actually a co-chair of the more moderate group, the Tuesday group. He sat down with the corresponding leaders of the House Freedom Caucus and negotiated changes to the bill they couldn't even get a vote on back in March, the American Health Care Act that Paul Ryan was pushing, the Speaker of the House. And he negotiated these changes to make the thing a little more palatable to the House Freedom Caucus, to the hardcore, to say, look, the states can opt out. If we require all these benefits to be part of everybody's insurance package, and by the way, that includes, things like maternity care, mental health, and so on. If we require that basic package, we'll still let the states opt out of that. And pre-existing conditions, well, if the states want to opt out and put together some kind of high-risk health care pool, that's fine, even if those haven't worked in the past. That's fine. We'll let the states do that. Well, that made the House Freedom Caucus happy because they like the idea of the states having that freedom to opt out. Well, on the basis of that, they got enough votes, and then they twisted a few arms and got a bunch of California Republicans to come on at the last second and pass the thing with one vote to spare. Now when you get out into the country, you find out people have a lot of questions about that. They're very sensitive to it, and they're afraid in some cases that their state might be one of the ones that opted out of that coverage protection.
Well, we're seeing that, Ron, but Juana, I'm wondering, is everyone having those concerns? There doesn't seem to be a breach in the wall of support from Trump voters. I mean, how do you read his support across the country now?
I think that one of the things we're likely to see is that members, as they go back to their districts for these congressional recesses, are having to kind of figure out how to grapple with this vote and things of that nature. The bill that passed in the House before lawmakers headed home doesn't have great odds in the Senate. And so I think the onus then is on the Senate to find something that they can bring back to their lawmakers that they can stomach, not just from Republicans, but for a broad swath of lawmakers.
That's Juana Summers, CNN politics editor, and Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent. I think as we've been talking, we haven't gotten any new tweets from President Trump, but we'll keep an eye out. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In Mississippi, 83-year-old Jack Zawadzki is suing the Picayune Funeral Home for refusing to cremate his husband of 2 years and partner of 52, Bob Husky, who died in a nursing home at 86. The Picayune Funeral Home denies the refusal was because of the couple's sexual orientation, but Lambda Legal, the nonprofit that advocates for LGBT rights, has joined the lawsuit. Lambda's Beth Luttrell is one of the lawyers. Beth, welcome.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Tell us a bit about this couple, Jack Zawadzki and Bob Husky, together for 52 years.
That's right. They were a loving couple who lived a very quiet and dignified life. They traveled together and lived in various states across the country and ended up retiring to Mississippi because they loved the climate and they loved their ability to just live their life in their home and take care of each other.
Jack Zawadzki grew camellias and Bob Husky was president of the Homeowners Association, quiet couple. And I know your group put a video together about the case. And here's a clip from that of Jack talking about his relationship with his late husband, Bob.
In 1962, I went to California and I met Bob there. We hit it off real good. So 6 months later, he moved in.
But now there's something that Jack can't do for his now late husband, Bob. What happened when the nursing home tried to arrange the cremation at the funeral home?
Jack's nephew, John, was very meticulous in researching the funeral homes in the area and had contracted with one of them to ensure that his uncle's remains would be properly cared for and that his other uncle would not have to go through the stress that accompanies having to make last-minute arrangements. And he was told that the funeral home was refusing to provide services, that when they determined that it was a same-sex couple, that they were not going to provide the services, pick up the body, and perform the cremation as they had arranged and agreed to do.
People might think that, well, there was just a huge Supreme Court ruling about gay marriage. Doesn't that extend to other rights of partners, you know, to have someone cremated, for instance? What is the law here?
Well, so a couple of things. One thing is to note that what this lawsuit illustrates is that anti-gay discrimination didn't vanish when the Supreme Court ruled that same-sex couples have the right to marry. And it really reflects the reality that marriage equality didn't usher in an era of actual equality throughout the country. The laws that were struck down by the Supreme Court in the Obergefell decision relate to what the government can and cannot do. And this is about what a private business can and cannot do. And it's in a state in which there are no anti-discrimination laws.
Well, let me hold you up there because people might be saying, wait a second, I've heard of all the cases of a baker who refused to make a wedding cake or a florist who refused to make a wedding bouquet for same-sex marriages. And weren't they not allowed to do that in some states? This varies state to state.
It varies state to state, and those are cases in which there are anti-discrimination laws that include sexual orientation. Mm. Those laws are not in every state, and what this lawsuit shows is that refusing service can happen at any point in someone's life if there are not anti-discrimination laws to protect them against this kind of outrageous discrimination.
Look, this caused incredible hardship and heartbreak in that moment for Jack and his nephew John, who now had to find other funeral homes, make huge drives to find someone who could do a cremation. The nursing home can't hold onto a body. Just suddenly, a terrible moment for them. And we hear the strings in your video pull at the heartstrings. But you have a funeral home who allegedly said to the nursing home, "We don't handle his kind." You know, what do you do about that fear and that attitude?
Well, laws don't change attitudes, but they do set out what is expected of people in society. Just as the Civil Rights Act didn't eliminate racial discrimination, it did send a message that overt discrimination was unlawful and would not be tolerated in society. And that message led to a reduction in attitudes and certainly in actions. You can't change someone's beliefs, but the law does have a profound effect on people's actions. And there should be laws that send a message that this kind of discrimination, that refusal to serve LGBT people is not tolerated.
Well, but right now there isn't an anti-discrimination law in Mississippi based on sexual orientation. So what's the basis of your lawsuit?
Well, we are suing under state law claims. There's a breach of contract claim. And there's also a claim for intentional infliction of emotional distress. And that is a claim that sets out a bar that people have to meet when they treat other people in a civilized society. And if they fall below that bar, if someone does something that makes you say, that is outrageous, it's not okay, you can sue and you can be compensated, including punitive damages.
By the way, how is your client Jack Zawadzki doing? 52 years of marriage, they're in their 80s. He said they weren't activists, they never took on anything, to just live these quiet lives growing flowers. And now, you know, thrown into the spotlight this way, how's he doing?
He's struggling on many levels. I mean, he's certainly filled with grief and loneliness and sadness over losing his best friend. You know, he talks about, you know, looking over the other side of the bed and it being empty. And it's a small town where he's already been discriminated against, and to now be public also creates a cloud of fear. But he's as any widow would be, struggling, and as any courageous plaintiff would be who brings a case based on discrimination, he's concerned for his safety.
Is he also getting support that he might not have expected?
He is. He is getting support from across the country, which is also a change for him. He didn't expect any of this to happen. He knew that his love was going to pass away, but he certainly didn't expect anything that followed from the day that his partner passed and was denied services until this moment. So he's doing the best he can.
That's attorney Beth Luttrell of Lambda Legal. Beth, thank you.
Thank you.
And we should note, on their website, the Picayune Funeral Home says there was no discrimination against Bob and Jack. They say there was simply no contract. They've served gay families, they say, and have had terrible threats since this lawsuit became public. So we'll follow this story. Well, let's go back to Washington, where this morning President Trump issued a flurry of angry tweets, and in two of them said, "As a very active president with lots of things happening, it is not possible for my surrogates to stand at a podium with perfect accuracy. Maybe the best thing to do would be to cancel all future, quote, press briefings and hand out written responses for the sake of accuracy? Question marks. Well, the president was likely responding to the preponderance of analysis that concluded that his version of the firing of James Comey, that he was going to do it anyway, was in contrast to his spokesman's version that he did it on advice of top Justice Department leaders. Let's bring in NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, your thoughts on that tweet?
Well, you know it'll never happen because he cares about the medium of television too much, but the president might as well slapped a decal on the forehead of anybody who comes out to speak for him and says you can't trust what comes out of their mouths. It's a crazy reminder, but it does remind or evoke the moment when Ron Ziegler, who was Richard Nixon's press secretary during Watergate, went in front of the podium and after a series of defenses over the Watergate things proved to be untrue, he just said those past statements are inoperative. Didn't take any responsibility for them, didn't say they were lies, didn't say how they got that way, just said they were inoperative, that is, no longer to be relied upon. that affects the credibility not only of the person saying it, but of the White House itself.
But people have been saying that the president this week has been Nixonian, and we've been commenting that another tweet that he sent out this morning seemed to threaten former FBI Director James Comey by saying, he better hope I don't have tapes of things that he said to me. And of course, you know, if you don't want to be compared to Richard Nixon, you don't talk about possibly having tapes.
You don't do that, and you don't invite Henry Kissinger in for a photo op. But we've had a lot of funny things this week.
Well, or invite Russians in when you're being questioned about your campaign's ties to Russians. Your thoughts on the Oval Office meeting with the Russian foreign minister and ambassador? The American press not allowed in, the Russian news agency TASS was.
An incredible snubbed the American press, an intentional poke in the eye. I mean, this was apparently a photographer who works for TASS, taking pictures of the event, and they went out under the Russian ministry sites and then went out on the TASS agency's site. This was seen as an incredible affront by the press, which did not itself get to go in, ask questions, or witness any of the exchanges between Trump and his Russian visitors.
Well, people worried about security. Nobody thinks that the Russian news agency is a free press. It might even be an espionage arm. I mean, there are those questions. But also, it meant that President Trump's White House lost the narrative. They didn't have any pictures to send out.
It was embarrassing all the way around. The White House didn't seem to expect pictures to be released of him shaking hands with the Russian ambassador, who was, of course, a key figure who played into the dismissal of former National Security Advisor Flynn.
Yeah. Look, just want to ask you briefly about the rollout of the firing of James Comey itself. Jenna Johnson in The Washington Post, terrific reporting on how Sean Spicer wanted to make the announcement in an email, but instead stuck his head in the press office in this harried moment. And then that night, White House aides, you know, it's been reported, were kind of shocked that Democrats weren't happier with the firing. But it led to this scene of, you know, spokespeople kind of huddling in bushes, trying to figure out what to say. You know, your sense of this White House's understanding of getting information out.
Getting accurate information to the public is in no way shown to be an important imperative of the people who populate this White House, starting from the guy at the top. Getting media coverage is. And you've seen this week, in a week of chaos and tumult, of mixed messages and unnecessary crisis, you've seen a president who nonetheless has courted the press. He's invited in NBC, The Economist, Time Magazine. He wants coverage and he obsesses over coverage. But the idea that coverage is supposed to reflect accurate information as opposed to what occurs to him in the moment, we've seen no evidence of that.
NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, thanks as always.
You bet.
Scientists are concerned with an effect of climate change that hasn't gotten much attention. Permafrost soils that have been frozen for thousands of years are melting, and as that happens, viruses and bacteria that have been dormant are springing back to life. Joining us now from Cardiff, Wales, is science writer Jasmine Fox-Skelly. Jasmine, you wrote about this for the BBC, and you describe a young boy who died from anthrax in the Arctic Circle. What happened?
Yes, this was August last year in a remote corner of Siberia called the Yamal Peninsula, and a 12-year-old boy sadly became infected by anthrax and died. But what was strange was how he had become infected. Scientists believe that a heat wave melted a layer of the frozen soil, and it had exposed the corpse of a reindeer that had actually died over 75 years ago from anthrax. And once exposed to the open air, the bacterial spores had spread into the nearby water supply and the soil and had infected the local reindeer and also a small percentage of the people of the village.
And this is thought to be a problem that could happen elsewhere?
Yeah, the concern is that as the earth warms, more permafrost is going to melt. And the truth is that we don't know what is down there. We know that there's anthrax, but there's a chance that also unknown diseases are down there.
Well, you also write about a smallpox epidemic in Siberia in the 1890s. What happened in that case?
Yeah, in that case, in Siberia, there was a deadly outbreak, actually, of smallpox, and it killed something like 40% of the population. Back then, and often still today, the way they dispose of bodies is basically they bury them. And so as the permafrost is melting, these sort of corpses could become exposed. And there's a concern, some are concerned, that diseases like smallpox could actually, they could come back to life.
Mm. So what can be done about this? Is there any way to prepare for this short of trying to stop climate change from occurring?
There's nothing massively that can be done. Of course, keeping stockpiles of vaccines just in case, any bacteria that does emerge from the ice, you know, you could treat it with antibiotics. as long as it doesn't have immunity. So I think the main thing that can be done is just be vigilant, monitor any outbreaks, and continue to research the area and the bacteria and look for it in the ice.
Now, the headline of your story reads, "There are diseases hidden in the ice and they are waking up," which sounds pretty scary, I must say.
Yeah, it's a catchy headline, but I wouldn't want anybody to be overly concerned, because not all bacteria and viruses can spring back to life. I mean, anthrax, the reason anthrax can is because it forms incredibly hardy spores. And a virus I talk about in my article is an example of a giant virus, and they're also extremely tough. And they've been able to be brought back. Also, some bacteria have been brought back by scientists that are millions of years old, potentially. But not all bacteria and viruses can survive. In fact, probably just a small fraction of them can.
And the same thing that is happening when the permafrost melts also happens when people start drilling down into the ground, correct?
Yeah, that's right. Obviously, with climate change, not only are ancient permafrost layers being exposed, but also Arctic sea ice is being exposed, and it's making areas much more available and accessible to mining. And so the fear is that as people go in and they go to these areas and they do lots of digging, that they'll actually expose these ancient layers. And we don't know what pathogens could be there.
That's Jasmine Fox-Skelly, who's a freelance writer based in Cardiff, Wales. We'll link to more about her story at hereandnow.org. Jasmine, thank you.
Thank you.
According to reports, many of the 42 commercial fishing licenses suspended in Maine last year involved people who broke fishing laws to buy opioids, some stealing lobsters from other people's traps. A Maine lobsterman was using OxyContin when he sailed into a storm in 2014. He was charged with maritime manslaughter after two sternmen died. And fishermen are overdosing at sea. Well, now the nonprofit Fishing Partnership in Massachusetts is giving some fishermen the overdose drug naloxone, Narcan, and training others how to use it. Steve Holler is a lobsterman who backs the program. He runs the November Gale out of Boston Harbor. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Keep you on land for a few minutes here. Also, Deb Kelsey, who works in support services at the Fishing Partnership. They're based in New Bedford, Massachusetts. She joins us in the studio as well. Hi, Deb.
Hello. Thank you for having us.
And Steve, I want to start with you because I know that you are seeing this issue among fellow lobstermen, but also in family.
Yeah, exactly.
Stepson?
Yes, I lost a stepson in 2013. He had succumbed to overdoses, I believe, 6 or 7 times, and Narcan did revive him during those episodes. Sadly, we did lose him in 2013.
So you're well aware.
Yes.
By the way, so sorry for the loss of your stepson. Deb, how common is it to lose someone at sea?
It's as common as losing someone at land.
Yeah.
The difference at sea is that the first responders, which would be the Coast Guard, aren't allowed to carry Narcan. So if there's an overdose at sea, that's a death. That's a fatal overdose.
It's done. There's no bringing someone back.
No chance.
Because there's no ambulance that can get out there.
That's right. You can't get out to the sea in an ambulance.
So talk about, I mean, how bad is the heroin epidemic within the fishing community? Is it worse than elsewhere?
So I would have to say no. It's throughout the community. In New Bedford, for example, there's overdoses every day, all day long. It's rampant in our community, in our cities, which includes the industry. Again, the importance on the waterfront is that if an overdose were to occur at sea, first responders don't have Narcan.
Well, we know that there are deaths in Gloucester, Massachusetts. The setting for the film, The Perfect Storm, Manchester by the Sea, was actually filmed in Gloucester. So we see these images of fishermen. 6 fishermen have overdosed right at the docks in the last 3 years. There was a man from Maine on March 1st. In New Bedford, Deb, where you're based, heroin was discovered on 6 of 11 outbound boats that were just searched randomly. So it's there.
Oh, it's there. It's everywhere in our city and in our ports. Mm. Not only addicts overdose, and we're trying to bring that education out to our industry and community. We tell our fishermen when we're bringing them awareness, you know, it may not be somebody on your vessel. It could be the vessel tied up next to you. It could be the vessel fishing next to you. Or it could be the little old lady next door who forgot she took her meds.
Well, Steve, I want to ask about that because it's not just addicts. Your industry in particular, well, are you on pain meds?
I am not now. No.
But you've been.
I have been. I have been for a very long time, degenerative disease, and I was on medication for up to 14 years.
Because this is a hard, hard job.
It is very hard. It's go, go, go. You only have so much time to make money, whether your permit's allowed to fish at a certain time or whether it be a weight quota or something like that. So it's they kind of used to call it derby fishing. You got to go and go when you can get the money. Fishermen are prescribed medications. It can be overprescribed. I can tell you I've been on Percocets for 14 years.
Well, you talk about once plowing through 120 Percocets in a month.
Yeah, that was my prescription. They were the smallest dosage of Percocets allowed, and it was for four Percocets a day, one in the morning, one late morning, one early afternoon, one late afternoon. And the perception is like when you give someone a painkiller that you are just totally numbing them up so they don't feel the pain. It's basically to maintain. You're not getting like, I want to say high or eliminating all the pain. You're still going to feel the pain. It's to keep you going.
And let's remind people, you're a lobsterman. How many traps?
800.
How much do they weigh each?
Oh, I would have to guess in the area around 65 pounds each.
And you're hauling them in?
Every day.
Every day.
Every day. I just had my arm rebuilt 3 years ago, tore all the tendons and ligaments out of it. The arm was just hanging there. And it was basically from every day. I've been doing this since the age of 14, 40
yeah.
years.
Yeah.
And the doctor jokingly says every once in a while a car door is going to fall off. You keep using it that much.
Right. So we have these two things, Steve. We have, you know, some of the fishermen, let's say it, the fishing industry is getting a little older.
Yes.
And hurting.
Yep.
Then you have people like your stepson mm-hmm. who was an addict in and around the fishing industry, might go out on occasion.
Yep.
So we have both things combined. Do you know others? I mean,
oh my gosh, I've gone to so many funerals, so many of my son's friends. I mean, we lost an entire generation. I mean, there was my son, two doors down, another son, five doors down, another son. They all played on the same baseball team. My son was a pitcher. The other gentleman was a first baseman. The other one was a third baseman. But they're all gone now. Oh. And they've pretty much all worked on my boat at one time. It's a sad, it was just a very, very sad thing.
No kidding.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. You know, we're talking about how the fishing industry is aging. It's just anecdotal, but partly because your younger generation is dying from mm-hmm. this opioid.
Yeah. It's not just the fishing community. The fishing community now is stepping forward. When we're out on the boat, the person might not be on our boat. He could be on another boat. He could be on a pleasure boat. But we're all on radio communication on different channels. Mm-hmm. If we hear something of someone, you know, that is in distress, whether it could be any reason at all, we've got pretty major first aid kits on the boat. Yeah. Through the Fishing Partnership, we are trained how to use them. Narcan, mm-hmm. CPR, through the Fishing Partnership, we are all getting trained. You know, it's a sad world we live in where I have a 16-year-old daughter. She will be working with me this year on the boat. She is fully trained. And vessel safety through Deb's organization, firefighting, CPR, how to use an AED, how to use Narcan. Both my daughters, 14 and 16, were trained in how to use Narcan. Because we used to joke around, you just about cut your finger off. What do? You wrap it up with electrical tape and you keep going. Well, you're going to lose that finger when you get in. So now it's like, okay, you know, let's get the proper first aid that we need on there and let's get you in to save that finger, save that thumb. I mean, we are the last cowboys, if that's what you want to call it, but we're getting a little smarter. You know, fingers and thumbs and hands and wrists are worth something, but a life is worth so much more. And to simply have Narcan in your kit. We as captains on the vessels, we are the first responders on the water.
And I was going to say, it could be a user or it could be someone just like you, Steve, who mixed up the pain medication.
That has happened to me.
That you have. Deb, this isn't just the Massachusetts area. I understand you just returned from New York's Montauk. Lucky you.
Yes.
One of the, you know, God's country there. But you're training fishermen there to use Narcan.
It's safety training for commercial fishermen. And in our basic first aid CPR class— just like we talk about how to use an EpiPen or an inhaler, we talk about how to recognize the signs of an overdose, how to administer Narcan, and the next step is to call Mayday call.
Do you get resistance?
I can honestly tell you that in the beginning, it was a challenge. I did have a captain in New Bedford. We trained his vessel. Reluctantly, he agreed to the training, didn't think he needed it. We basically tag-teamed him to get him to agree.
You and Steve, yeah.
He said he didn't have, you know, there was no need for it on his vessel, but was going to take the training anyways. 3 months later, I was reaching out to him regarding another matter, and he answered the phone and told me he was on his way in from his trip. And he was like, "Deb, I'm on my way in." He's like, "I had to use that Narcan that you gave me. I can't believe it."
He's a big advocate now for this with Deb on the waterfront.
That was a true testament there. And that crew member is alive today because this captain was equipped with education and Narcan. And he said to me while he was administering the Narcan that he never once thought about this person being a junkie. All he wanted to do was revive him.
Good work.
Thank you.
That's Deb Kelsey. She works in support services at the Fishing Partnership. We're going to link you up at our website to their services. We've also been talking to Steve Holler, lifelong lobsterman, lost a stepson to an opioid overdose and is determined not to lose anyone else. Thank you both.
Thank you.
And by the way, both Steve and Deb are also recovery coaches who help after someone's been revived for more. And we'd love to hear from fishermen. Go to hearandnow.org.
With all the political news this week, here's a story you may have missed. It's about Jerry Goldsmith, who was just honored this week in Hollywood with a star on the Walk of Fame. Goldsmith was a force at the movies for more than 50 years. His Oscar-nominated film scores include Planet of the Apes, Patton, Chinatown, and Hoosiers. He died in 2004 at the age of 75. Tim Grieving tells us who he was.
Unlike a lot of folks on the Walk of Fame, Jerry Goldsmith needs an introduction. And the best way to do that is by sampling a few of his more than 200 film scores. In the 1970s, he scored three American classics. He gave George C. Scott's Patton, Ghostly Trumpets, and A Contagious March. Then, Goldsmith wrote a noir score for four pianos, four harps, and solo trumpet for Chinatown in only 10 days after the original composer's work was thrown out. Robert Towne wrote the Oscar-winning screenplay for Chinatown.
That score made that movie, really. I think it was a movie waiting for that score.
The American Film Institute ranks it one of the 10 best scores of all time. Two years later, Goldsmith wrote a satanic mass for The Omen. The film's director, Richard Donner, remembers the first musical cue they recorded, a scene with a dog walking along a balcony.
And Jerry was conducting these people, and they started with these wonderful voices going, "Antique Cristo, antique." Every step the dog took, "Antique Cristo." And I got these shivers down my back. It made that scene and my buddy, that dog, the Rottweiler, which I used to hang around with, it made him the most ferocious, dangerous animal that ever happened.
The Omen won Goldsmith his only Oscar out of 18 nominations. But he set the bar high for his peers, as Breakfast at Tiffany's composer Henry Mancini said at a dinner for Goldsmith in 1993.
He has instilled two things in his colleagues in this town. One thing he does, he keeps us honest. And the second one is he scares the hell out of us. You do, Jerry. You're just perfect.
In the 80s and 90s, one of Goldsmith's go-to directors was Joe Dante on such offbeat films as The Burbs and Gremlins.
The one thing that we used to say to ourselves on the set when things were going badly, we'd say, don't worry, Jerry will save it. And more often than not, he did.
Goldsmith's favorite scores were for two sports movies, Hoosiers and Rudy. For Hoosiers, he wrote a poignant main theme and game music that used samples of real bouncing basketballs. Director David Anspaugh wasn't sure the combination of electronics and orchestra would work for his film set in the Midwest in the 1950s.
It made us nervous as hell, quite honestly.
But when the music was laid against the picture,
I was blown away. I couldn't believe that I actually had my name on it because he made us all look so good.
Jerry Goldsmith got his start in the early days of television, scoring episodes of The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and The Twilight Zone, among others. And he grew up in L.A. in the shadow of the movie business. But his widow Carol says he was primed for a different career.
Jerry was being trained since he was a young boy to be a concert pianist. And it wasn't until he was 13, when he went to the movie Spellbound, that he fell in love with film and dramatic scoring.
That's one of Goldsmith's best-known themes for Star Trek The Motion Picture. It was reused for the subsequent TV series. And while his career ran parallel to that of Star Wars composer John Williams, he never had that kind of popular name recognition. Still, he had a big effect on those who followed him, like Austin Wintory, a Grammy-winning composer for film and video games. Wintory says he decided he wanted to write music for movies when he was 10 after hearing a Goldsmith soundtrack.
I know that virtually every composer seemingly worships him. I mean, I've often heard Williams is like the composer of the people. Goldsmith is the composer's composer.
Goldsmith did score a number of pop hits, Alien, the Rambo films, Basic Instinct, Poltergeist. But his resume is also littered with titles like Rent-A-Cop and Mr. Baseball. Carol Goldsmith says he scored every film like it was the next Chinatown.
He approached each project as the best assignment he might be given and gave it his all.
So, now you know who Jerry Goldsmith is, you've got some listening to do. For NPR News, I'm Tim Grieving in Los Angeles.
And later this afternoon on All Things Considered, we'll get the latest on the cyber attack in England that targeted hospitals across the country. The attackers demanded ransom payments in bitcoins to regain access to patient files. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.